conservation of natural resources, to uphold nonviolence, peaceful coexistence, and harmony, and to help area people become more conscious of peace and the purpose it is in their daily life.
Well, I'm glad you called about that, because that's a cool idea.
Wait a minute, I'm not quite done. So the events start September 21st, which is the International Day of Peace, with the Salem Area Peace Festival, and then ends on United Nations Day celebration, October 24th at the Peace Plaza in Salem with dancing, music, and food. Okay, so in the intervening period between September 22nd and October 23rd, they hope that various individuals and organizations will organize peace events in Salem and its neighboring communities. So these events may include training in mediation, nonviolence, conflict resolution, talks and symposiums on peace, flash mobs, peace-building activities like peace games, peace vigils.
Yeah,
peace
walks. I have to cut you off only because we're out of time. I hope people do the Salem thing. I think it sounds great. I love the prep. I love flash mobs. Hey, I got to get off the air. This is KBOO 90.7 on the FM dial. This was Positively Revolting. Joe Uris here sitting in for the wonderful women who do the show. You stick around. KBOO will bring you something that's built on the ground. See you later.
What did the blue one went away? The other blue are f***ing well. She was noisy every night. I had to always chicken bite.
Ezekiel Kincaid's International House of Chicken, where you pick out your own live chicken. You slaughter your...
I'm out to sing songs. It'll prove to you that this is your world. And that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that'll make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Movin' On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial and only on KBOO.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the second annual Debtors Assembly Portland on Saturday, July 12th from 3 to 6 p.m. at Holiday Park, located at Northeast 11th and Holiday near the Lloyd Center MAX stop. Hosted by Strike Debt Portland, the Debtors' Assembly will be a public gathering of neighbors and community leaders, seeing debt in a new way, one of social justice. Experts will speak on how the debt industries work and how they enable poverty and wealth inequality. And finally, organizers will lead group conversation on building creative ideas for local collective resistance against unjust debts. Again, that's Saturday, July 12th at 3 p.m. in Holiday Park. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is about 9:04 a.m. Coming up, Don Merrill interviews civil rights pioneer Dr. Benjamin Chavez, who was recently appointed president and CEO of the National Newspaper Publishers Association. Followed at 9:30, Jenka Soderberg hosts a report from Gaza with Rami Al-Magari on the military escalation by the Israeli army on the people of Gaza. At 10 is Air Cascadia, followed by Flashpoints, which devotes the entire show covering the massive Israeli air assault on the Gaza Strip. At 11, it's The Digital Divide with your host, Rabia Yemin, speaking with Howard Bloom. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support for community radio. Those who are not yet a KBOO member can rectify that situation at kboo.fm. Click where it says Donate Today.
I'm Don Merrill, and I'm talking with Dr. Benjamin Chavis. Dr. Chavis has been the former director of the NAACP, the former director of the Million Man March. He is currently the president and CEO of the National Newspaper Publishers Association, an organization that advocates and supports black publishers of black media and newspapers around the United States. Before the interview started, Dr. Chavis, you and I had a long and very extensive conversation about a lot of issues, and we're going to touch on some of those issues, but I wanted to start out with some background. Mm-hmm. I had done some research and found out that when you were 13, a childhood friend of yours told the New York Times that you went into the whites-only Richard H. Thornton branch of the Oxford Public Library in Oxford, North Carolina. And when you were told to leave by the librarian, you asked a question no other black child to that point had apparently asked. And the question was, why? And after that, that act eventually led to the opening of the library to everybody in the community. Did you have in your mind the intention of making the library accessible when you were 13? Or was it really just your intention to get in there and get better quality books than the one that you were holding in, at that moment?
No, my intention was to make the library accessible not only for my fellow African-American students in the high school in Oxford, North Carolina, but to make it accessible to everybody. I had passed by that library many times, and I thought about it. So on that particular day, I just got up enough courage to say, I'm not passing by this library anymore. I learned early in life that if you see an injustice and keep passing by it, guess what? It's never going to stop. It's never going to change. So even at 13, I, was probably a little angry at myself that I waited so long. I should have done it when I was 9 or 10 or 11. The Chavis family had a long tradition of being freedom fighters, civil rights workers. I was an NAACP youth member when I was 12.
Right. Your father got you involved in the NAACP?
That's correct. And both my parents were school teachers. And I knew something of my great-great-great-grandfather, the Reverend John Chavis, who was the first African-American to be ordained as a Presbyterian minister in the United States.
And apparently he was also the first graduate of Princeton University.
That's correct. But he was also beaten to death because he published a book entitled Atonement that questioned slavery, that questioned white supremacy from a religious perspective. I wanted to know why were... as we refer to as colored people, why were we so content with allowing discrimination? I knew something was wrong, but then I began to believe that maybe we were contributing to the wrong by not challenging the wrong. And this is my little adolescent thinking at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So even though I knew how to spell the word racism by the time I was 12, I knew what it meant. Beyond the definition in the dictionary, I saw the reality in my life. You know, my parents would go up and buy some gas. I saw people younger than them calling my mother and father by their first name. I didn't like that. I had respect for my parents. I wanted everybody else to respect my parents. I loved to go to the movies. I couldn't go to the movies in my home. I couldn't go to the swimming pool. Couldn't go to the car. In my hometown, you couldn't even carry it.
Do you ever go back to your hometown?
I go back all the time. I go back to that library. The Richard Thornton Library is still there.
When you were one of the Wilmington Ten, and for those that don't know, the Wilmington Ten were a group of African-American men and one woman who were convicted of firebombing a Wilmington, North Carolina grocery store in 1971. You were incarcerated for 5 years before you were released, and then... Governor Beverly Perdue pardoned you and the rest of the Wilmington Ten in December 2012.
Right, 40 years later.
During a press conference, she said these convictions were tainted by naked racism and represent an ugly stain on North Carolina's criminal justice system that cannot be allowed to stand any longer. Justice demands that this stain finally be removed. Have you ever thought about why it took so long for you to get that pardon?
Well, it was a very courageous act by the Honorable Governor Beverly Perdue, who incidentally was the first female governor, Democratic governor, And I was, we all were so grateful and thankful. We knew over this long struggle of 4 decades that eventually we would have our names cleared of that injustice. It took a while.
Well, the thing is, you served 5 years of what was intended to be a 35-year sentence, I believe.
That's correct.
And the reason why you only served 5 years is because 3 of the witnesses recanted their accounts.
Yes.
So 5 years into a sentence in 1976, essentially, you were found to be innocent.
That's correct. But, you know, well, the courts overturned that. Even after the witnesses recanted, we still were in jail. Our convictions were not overturned until December 4th, 1980 by the Fourth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals. And even though our convictions were overturned, the charges were never dropped against us. So the state, for another 30 years, could have brought us back to trial. That was always hanging over our heads. And it's very important to say that we received a pardon of innocence, not just a regular pardon. A regular pardon, you know, we forgive you. We know what you did wrong, but we're going to forgive you. No. This was a pardon of innocence where the state admitted on the record that we were innocent, that we should never have been arrested, should never have been tried, should never have been incarcerated, should never have been punished. Why were the Wilmington 10 put in prison in the first place? Because we were trying to get equal opportunity, equal education, equal access to quality education for black, white, and other youth. We believed that the public school system ought to afford the same opportunities to all children without respect or discrimination as to race. That was the whole issue.
Your father was a preacher, but after a couple of years at St. Augustine College, your first degree was for chemistry.
Yes.
From the University of North Carolina in 1969. What steered you to the sciences rather than the pulpit in your early years?
Well, both my sister, who's 1 year younger than me, her name is Francine, we both were chemistry majors. We were going to both be physicians. We had an interest in wanted to study medicine, and we both became chemistry majors in different schools. But during the 1960s, I was also the state youth coordinator for the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. So even though I was a science student, I was also a civil rights youth organizer. And quite frankly, I became a better student in the laboratory studying chemistry because of what I was doing outside of the laboratory in the streets, organizing people to protest, organizing people to lift their voices up. I learned a lot about how to synthesize aspirations in people and build movements, the science of putting things together, holes in a laboratory, but also holes in the streets.
After your conviction as a member of the Wilmington 10, you continued to go to school at
Yes.
Duke University, and you earned a master's degree from the Divinity School under a release study program, but you went back and forth to class in leg irons. I can't even imagine what that must have been like.
I finished Duke University magna cum laude with a master's of Divinity while I was in prison. So they would take me to Duke University every morning, 8 a.m., in chains. I'd get out of the prison van, go to class. At 5 o'clock, the van would come back, pick me up, put the chains back on, take me back to prison.
When you were in prison, you wrote a book called Psalms from Prison.
Yes.
And that was 3 years after your release, you wrote that. Was that a way for you to reconcile with yourself what had happened to you or to give strength to the men that were still there or to let people know what you had gone through?
It was a combination, all of those reasons. But keep in mind, I published the book 3 years after, but I actually wrote the book while I was in. I was sending out little pieces of paper at a time to my parents when they would visit me. I wanted to document the prison experience from an existential faith perspective. You know, David wrote 150 Psalms, so Reverend Chavis wrote 150 Psalms, but I wrote my Psalms in the context of a prison cell. It's amazing what theological reflection takes place in a prison cell in America.
I want to move forward in time now. When you were the director of the NAACP, you were the director between 1993 and 1994, the organization was just beginning to dabble with the idea of corporate sponsorships as a way to bring in revenue. Now, in recent years, the organization has been criticized by some for taking that money in exchange for turning a blind eye to civil rights injustices from some of those same companies. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it is a little ironic that we expect our freedom organizations only to get their subsistence from corporate contributions. So whoever controls the money ultimately controls the organization. And if we're not careful, the principle can be compromised for the lack or for the need of money. I think that African Americans in particular, it's been well documented now in 2014, we are spending over $1 trillion in the U.S. economy. But very little of that money is to sustain and to support our freedom-fighting organizations like the NAACP or the Urban League or the Southern Christian Leadership Conference or Operation Push or Reverend Sharpton's organization, the National Action Network. We've got a lot of organizations. But all of them are struggling trying to get that corporate dollar. I think that we should maintain the historic and the contemporary purposes of our civil rights organizations, our freedom-fighting organizations, and not be compromised. But on the other hand, I also believe that because we spend so much in this economy, a lot of these Fortune 500 companies become Fortune 500 companies because of our consumerism. So I do believe that those companies owe something back to the community. A lot of these companies extract money, extract capital from the African-American community and other minority communities, but put nowhere near proportionate back in the communities from which they extract their profits and their capital.
I want to talk a little bit about your new position here at the National Newspaper Publishers Association. How did you get the job?
Well, I wrote a letter. I sought the job. You do have to be elected by the board of the National Newspaper Publishers Association. They had a vacancy. Then I had several meetings with the executive committee and the full board of the National Newspaper Publishers Association. They asked me what my sense of direction would be if they would retain me to be their new executive. And I was very clear. All my life, I've been in the empowerment business. I believe in helping people maximize their God-given gifts and talents. And a lot of our newspapers are struggling to survive. A lot of our black colleges are struggling to survive. And part of the reasons why they're struggling is because it's a statement of the economy in the black community. A dollar stays in our community, you know, less than 4 hours. I mean, as soon as they get it, it's out. But in other communities that represent the demographics of the United States, dollars not only circulate sometimes 2 weeks, sometimes 2 months. I mean, it stays in the community. We don't do that. So we have, that's why a lot of times there's friction in many urban areas, because a lot of immigrant brothers and sisters come from other countries. They participate in the financial system. Before you know it, they own businesses. They're thriving. So what's wrong with the brothers and sisters who were born here? Why can't we thrive? And I think it's part of our consciousness. You know, it's just not about material acquisition. You got to know the difference between an appreciating asset and a depreciating asset. You know, if you're going to bling, you know, what is that representative? You know, what are you trying to achieve? And then we need to raise our young people up. When I was growing up, I knew the value of saving. I knew the value of having a plan in life. I knew the value of respecting my parents, and to the point of even defending my community or my family from anything that would impinge upon the quality of a life, and so that the voice of black America will be a strong voice. It will be a penetrating voice, an accountable voice, a voice that is not kowtowing or compromising with forces that we know will be destructive to our reality. The world is changing, and I think for the better. And technology, the role of technology. I want to mention that we have to utilize technology to support the print world, not to supplant it or take its place, but to support it and make it much more effective. And of course, I'm going to strengthen the voice of the NNPA and therefore strengthen the voice of Black America. But I'm also going to do it in a way that's much more inclusive. I don't believe that we should always compartmentalize ourselves just based on race or ethnicity or language. But on the other hand, I don't think we should allow certain forces like all this voter suppression that's going on now. It's definitely targeted at our communities. We have to fight against that. You can't have a democracy if that democracy is not totally inclusive, inclusive of all people. So we do have to fight. I think there's more reason in 2014, 2015 for a civil rights movement than ever before. Next year, we're going to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act. At a time, the Supreme Court of the United States is trying to erode the Voting Rights Act. There are members of Congress that are trying to erode the Voting Rights Act. We've got to fight. The right to vote is sacred. It's blood-soaked. We sacrifice too much to allow somebody to erode those things. But the same thing now, going back to the publishers, sometimes I think we take freedom of expression, freedom of the press, I think we take some of these freedoms too lightly. And I think that my role now as the president and CEO of the National Newspaper Publishers Association is to assert the fundamental human right of freedom of the press, freedom of expression, but do it in a way that brings people together rather than divide people.
You know, it's interesting that you say that, because earlier you were talking about how when you were growing up, you know, you wondered why friends and family seemed content to be where they were. And just now you said, you know, why is it that the publishers don't seem to be doing more to advocate for themselves and to be the voice of the Black community? And it sounds like that sense of contentment, that tendency to be okay where you are, hasn't changed a whole lot over the last, or 50 years.
One of the things I learned, you know, I worked directly with the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and he used to tell all of us in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference two things. We have to be impatient with injustice. But on the other hand, we have to be patient with the victims of injustice. A lot of I'm writing an article now about the history of the Black press. We just don't know all of the Black press that were dynamited, burned. Some publishers lost their lives because they dare to print the truth about what was going on with Black people in America. And I think that in my briefcase right now, I have the last printed Jet magazine. Years ago, Jet was like the weekly non-sectarian Bible in the Black community. In terms of for information. So that's a void now. So one part of my role in the National Newspaper Publishers Association is I'm not engaging in any funerals. You know, I'm gonna lead revivals for the Black press, because I got to revive the sentiment. We cannot lower our own self appreciation of where we are, and particularly the importance of Black business. But it's just not only Black publishers. I could say the same thing for Black bankers. There's a decline in ownership of automobile ownerships. It's across the board. There's a general decline. We don't own Essence magazine. We don't own BET. So what I'm saying is, rather than become cynical and talk about all of our challenges and all of our wiles and all of the problems exclusively, yes, we have to talk about that, but not, I'm bringing balance.
You know, in any market, there are the producers and there are the consumers. Now, you're representing an organization that essentially are the producers. But what do you do when the producers are suffering in part because the consumers are not consuming?
That's my job. And I like the way you put it. My job is to get producers connected to the consumers and to get consumers connected to the producers. I want some of the consumers to become producers. People not just to want a job, I want them to become the employer, not just the employee. What is our mission? I'm not in favor of sustaining soup lines. I'm not in favor of sustaining just giving out charitable contributions.
You had said that when you were a preacher, it was very difficult sometimes for you to get up in front of a congregation and to emphasize, you know, what is commonly emphasized in church, which is charity, because you said that for you, sometimes that didn't seem to be the solution.
No, I want, this is a funny kind of church. I would pass the plate to give people something rather than to take from people. You know, I want to give people the encouragement that they know how to improve their lives. I do a lot of marriage counseling, and it's very simple. If you want your marriage to work, it's what you put into it. It's not what you take from it. The institutions that we build, whether it's the church or the press or the colleges, it's what we put into the people, not what we take from the people. It's what we give the people. You know, I know the solution to that problem in Chicago with all these young brothers killing each other. You know, you give these young men hope and get the gun out of their hand, put a book in their hand, and get some consciousness, some black consciousness, as well as some human consciousness, we turn this whole situation around.
You had mentioned earlier that you had connected the problems with the NNPA and HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities. And earlier when we were talking, I got the impression that part of the reason was because of the slow adaptation of technology. Do you think that that is one of the tools for finding a solution to the problem with both?
I think it's one of the tools that we must organize means and methods to make new technology and innovation serve the community rather than we serve the technology. I see everybody with a device in their hand. Well, I'm going to make sure that what's on your device is really helping to improve your quality of life. That's our responsibility. It would be mad for me to say, I want everybody to put their devices down, stop using the device. No, I want you to use your device, but I want you to use your device toward what end? I want to make sure you get the right information. If you look at mainstream media, it becomes very depressing. Fox News is very depressing. But they're making a lot of money depressing and dividing and polarizing America. I see the NNPA as the antidote.
And you had spoken earlier about how some of these talk show commentators who have created these very profitable and very effective niche markets, they are merely exploiting business principles and opportunities. And we had talked, and you had said that some folks had come to you asking you to sort of be the anti-Sean Hannity, the anti-Rush Limbaugh, and you declined
right.
to do that.
I declined to do that because, to me, if I was the anti-Hannity or the anti-Rush Limbaugh, it would only make them stronger and me weaker. I'm going to transcend them. I've got another way to handle those guys. We're going to put out positive truth against their negative untruth.
In 1997, you took the name Muhammad as your last name, and you wanted to join the Nation of Islam while staying a minister in the United Church of Christ. The UCC didn't allow that, and the Eastern North Carolina Association of the UCC voted to terminate your ministerial standing. I wanted to ask you, what moves have you made to United Church of Christ members and the Muslim nation in building relationships with both of them since that issue?
Absolutely. But, you know, I become a living example of not only interfaith dialogue, but increasing awareness. Because at the end of the day, we all serve the same God, not different gods. And if we serve the same God, if Christians, Jews and Muslims believe in the same God, then why are we having all this friction between us? I don't think religion should be dividing up people, making people engage in hatred based on your religion. I think that, and this is my journey. I've had a faith journey. And I've recently, you know, renewed my credentials with the Eastern North Carolina Association of the United Church of Christ. In fact, I'm leading a revival in Henderson, North Carolina next month. But at the same time, we evolve, and I'm still evolving. But now, as the new president and CEO of the National Newspaper Publishers Association, we're going to be writing about religion, but we're going to write about it in a way that encourages people, not divide people. I think that we've sometimes become too judgmental as a society, where we want to judge another person if they're not just like you. We want to judge another person because they don't worship like you. We want to judge another person because they speak a different language or they're from a different part of the world. I don't think that's right. And I believe that something that Reginald Lewis told me, and Reginald F. Lewis was the first African-American billionaire, did the largest leverage buyout in the United States. I asked him, give me one word out of the English language that determined your success. And Reggie said, that word is preparation. So I see all of what I've been through is preparing me for the task that I have before me now with the National Newspaper Publishers. James Baldwin was a close friend of mine. He said, the pen is mightier than the sword. I believe that. But we got to pick up our pens and write. We got to express ourselves on radio. We got to not only look right on TV, we got to act right. And we got to try to inspire and encourage millions of people not only to know what the right path is, but to get on that right path and to stay on that right path. And don't let some popular wind just blow you off track.
I'm Don Merrill, and I've been talking with Dr. Benjamin Chavis. Dr. Chavis.